To introduce the next speaker, Dr. Jay Schweitzer is the Donald Castleman Professor of Discovery in the Department of Chemistry. He's also an adjunct professor in materials science and engineering, senior research investigator in the Materials Research Center. And he's going to be talking to us about epitaxial electrodeposition of metal oxide thin films and super lattices for energy conversion and storage. Dr. Jay Schweitzer.
I just realized that that title would actually scare a lot of people off. So I'll try to explain some of these things as we go along. But basically, we're using chemical and electrochemical processing to make nanoscale materials, basically starting with molecules and building up to the materials. So I'm going to give a brief introduction on the electrodeposition of ceramic films. So we mostly work with ceramic materials. And I'll give three examples then. This is all unpublished work. Some work on making tilted zinc oxide nanospheres epitaxially grown on silicon. And this, a potential application, we actually haven't made devices yet with this, but potential applications would be in photovoltaics and solid-state lighting. So you could go either from taking light and generating electricity or using electricity to generate light. So this is a large band gap material that we're putting on top of silicon. So the idea there is that you have two band gaps. You have the large band gap zinc oxide on the top with a smaller band gap like silicon on the bottom. So you're using a larger fraction of the solar spectrum. So you're, instead of being limited by the band gap of silicon to about 20 or 24% efficiency, by having multiple band gaps, you can go up into 30 or 40% efficiency. And likewise, by applying a voltage to these things, you can get them to emit light. And our material actually emits light about the wavelength of this laser. It emits green light. So the second part will be growing super lattices, and these are layered structures where the layers are only a couple of nanometers thick, and this is based on magnetite. It's a magnetic oxide. So the application here is not sort of remote to the energy field, but it's making magnetic sensors and memory such as resistive RAM. So we're talking about making what are called defect chemistry super lattices based on magnetite, and compositional superlattices based on zinc-doped magnetite. And then the final part would be related to the storage of energy. So we're making nanostructured lithium manganese oxide that could be used for lithium-ion cathodes. So first of all, to deposit these materials, again, we're starting with either molecular or ionic precursors. And most of our work is on electrodeposition, where, say, we electrochemically oxidize, in this case, iron 2 to iron 3 to make a mixed iron 3 oxide. So it's a chemical reaction, but it's occurring right at an electrode surface. So it's actually one of the things that's an advantage of this electrodeposition method is that you're growing the material out from the electrode surface. So you have electrical continuity from the very top of the film all the way down to the electrode surface. And when we first got into this field, we were interested in the low-cost aspects of electrodeposition. Basically, you're doing it in a beaker or a bucket. And compared to, say, molecular beam epitaxy, it's quite inexpensive. But we found that in addition to that, you have other control that you might not have in high vacuum methods by adding additives or by controlling the potential. For instance, you can deposit nanostructures that you may not be able to deposit other ways. So this is the more obvious way from electrochemistry. This is like electroplating, except instead of making metals, we're making oxides. You can also use this method to electrochemically generate base, which then will react with metal ions to form, say, zinc oxide in this case, or calcite in this case. Or you can generate acid to, for instance, react with the zincate ion to make zinc oxide. So these are two different ways to make zinc oxide, which is sort of an indirect method. But again, we're titrating the solution, but we're doing it right at the electrode surface. So these are some examples of some previous work that we've done, and this is zinc oxide on gold. So these are epitaxial, and by epitaxial, what we mean is that we have a single crystal, and we're growing something on top of it, and the single crystal is determining the orientation of the deposit, both the out-of-plane orientation and the in-plane orientation. And the first example is zinc oxide. It always grows like this as little nano columns. These are typically 50 to 100 nanometers in diameter. But the interesting thing, like I say, is they grow from the electrode surface out, so you have continuity, and you know they can be grown to be microns long, but only, say, 50 nanometers in diameter. This is, again, another case, silver oxide. It grows as nanoplatelets. That's used actually in batteries. And again, it makes contact to the surface. This is cuprous oxide. This is an intermediate band gap material that it could also be used for solar cells. It has a band gap of about 2 electron volts. And that grows epitaxially on indium phosphide, which is kind of an unexpected result from aqueous solution. And this is some work that we did over the last couple years on copper oxide. This is actually a chiral catalyst that can be used to make chiral chemicals that can be of interest for the pharmaceutical industry. So I'd like to start with zinc oxide. There's a lot of interest in zinc oxide right now. There's thousands and thousands of papers that are coming out on zinc oxide. It's a very busy field. I sometimes wonder why I'm in it. So this is some work out of Berkeley where they've grown these nanowires of zinc oxide. And each one of these is a little single crystal. And it actually can act as a nano laser. And this is the output right here of a nano laser based on zinc oxide. That's been shown, at least theoretically, that zinc oxide and gallium nitride can serve as hosts to make a magnetic material. So if you dope these materials, this hasn't really been shown, hasn't been proved yet, but if you can dope these materials with magnetic ions, you can make high Curie temperature magnets. It's been used as a quantum Hall device, and from the Fred Lang's group at Santa Barbara, they've actually shown that with the proper additives, instead of growing it as nanowires like I showed, you can actually get it to grow out and get lateral overgrowth to make it look more like silicon. You can grow bulk films. So actually, in this particular case, I'm actually not talking about electrodeposition. We have a really simple way to deposit zinc oxide. Found this out by accident that we can do chemical bath deposition of epitaxial zinc oxide on silicon. So we basically just take our silicon wafer and dunk it in a solution that is super saturated in zincate ion. And we make a solution that's right there, that's right over the solubility limit for zinc. Zinc is an amphoteric material, so as you increase the pH, the solubility goes down, and then after around pH 9 or 10, then the solubility goes up again. So we make a solution right here. We dunk our silicon wafer in it. We can also electrode deposit, but in this case, we're just doing a chemical bath deposition. And we get these little nanospheres that grow on the surface. And this was pretty perplexing for a while, because we would take these samples that we could see by scanning electron microscopy had these nanospheres on there. But we look at it by X-ray diffraction, and we didn't see anything except for the silicon peaks. And it turns out that this material is epitaxial, but instead of being vertically aligned, the nanospheres are at an angle of 51 degrees, and they don't actually satisfy the Bragg condition, and you don't even see it in the X-ray pattern. So if you do what's called an X-ray pole figure, where you tilt the sample and rotate it, then you see peaks for the silicon, and they're at 51 degrees relative to the normal. So we found that these things are actually epitaxial, but they're a really weird orientation. And it turns out it's because the silicon and zinc oxide have very different structures. Zinc oxide is a hexagonal structure, and silicon is cubic, and the lattice parameters are vastly different. And nature decides that, it's not going to grow vertically like it does on gold, like I showed you before, but it's going to grow at an angle of 51 degrees. What that does is it brings this weird plane, the 203 plane, in coincidence with the silicon 100 plane, and ends up being epitaxial just by accident. So this is a little cartoon of what it looks like, and this is how the atoms would line up, and it actually gives you really low lattice mismatch, and that's why it does it. So from the point of view of a photovoltaic, this is really interesting because each one of these is a little single crystal, and it's in an epitaxy relationship with a silicon. So if you can generate carriers, you know, in the zinc oxide, either directly by irradiating with the UV light or by, you know, say dye sensitization, you can inject carriers into the silicon that can travel along the single crystal down to the silicon. So you have a short path here for electron holes separation. So you can minimize electron hole recombination, and then you also have no grain boundaries between the top surface and the bottom. The tricky part, though, for making solid-state photovoltaic cells, which we haven't done yet, is to actually make contacts to the surface, because these little nanospheres are a little difficult to contact. So the next thing I'd like to talk about is the work we're doing on superlattices, and we're working with magnetite, which is, you know, one of the original magnetic materials, and it's Fe304. It has iron 2 and iron 3 in it, and the iron 3s have their spins anti-ferromagnetically coupled so that the net ferrimagnetism is due to the iron 2. It's actually known from calculations done here at Mizzou to have 100% spin polarization at the Fermi level, so it's of great interest for spintronic devices, and it also has a high Curie temperature of 860 Kelvin, so you can use it at room temperature. And there's belief that magnetite is actually used for magnetoreception or navigation in animals. For instance, there are bacteria that have little single crystals of magnetite that they grow. Now, we don't know if it's really using that for navigation or if it's actually just growing there, and that's it's there, and it's not actually serving any purpose. But it definitely is in several different bacteria, and it's also found, for instance, in the beaks of homing pigeons. And it's a magnetite hematite layered structure, which is actually very similar to the superlattices we're making. So it could be that the homing pigeon decides where it's going based on this magnetite that's in its beak. So what we're doing is we're making spintronic devices where we have a magnetic material and either a tunnel barrier or a non-magnetic material between that and another magnetic material, and we can have either the spins lined up, parallel spins, and then it'll have low resistance. You can tunnel from here to here with high probability, or you can flip the spins and it'll have high resistance because it'll have low tunneling probability. So you can use this as a very sensitive sensor for magnetic fields. And also, I just show here some pictures. This is Fe304 that we've grown on gold 111, so it grows epitaxially, that we can also see from an X-ray pole figure. And this is some earlier work that we've done on making spintronic devices where we can measure the magnetoresistance. This is at room temperature versus magnetic field. But what I'd like to talk about today, this is some work that we've actually just submitted, so it's not published yet, on growing superlattices based on magnetite. So superlattice is a sandwich compound. It's a layered structure where you have layers A, B, and each layer can be, you know, just a couple of nanometers thick, and it has planes in it that are periodic, but then superimposed on that, you have this ABAB periodicity, so they're called superlattices for that reason. And the superperiodicity, that's supposed to be a lambda right there. That's a Mac to PC problem. So we deposit these materials. In this case, we're actually starting with iron 3, and we're starting with iron 3 complex. It's complex with triethanolamine in strong base. We work in strong base all the time. And so we're electrochemically reducing the iron 3 to iron 2, and then that reacts with additional iron 3. So this is an electrochemical reaction, reacting in a chemical reaction then to make the magnetite. And the trick here is that if you look at a linear sweep voltammogram, as you drive the potential more negative, you become mass transport limited out here at more negative potentials. And you can then control the concentration, the surface concentration of iron 2 and iron 3, which we've calculated here. So at low or more positive potentials, you have basically the bulk concentration of iron 3, but as you drive it the potential more negative, your concentration of iron 3 at the surface goes to zero, whereas if you have zinc in the solution, it remains constant. So what we found is we can basically vary the zinc concentration in a zinc ferrite by varying the applied potential. So this is the calculated composition, and these are what we measured. We can also grow films then at a series of potentials, and we grow films that have different lattice parameters. So we're actually controlling the stoichiometry of the film through the potential. So that way, then if we want to grow a super lattice, then we just pulse the potential between, say, here and here, and we alternately put down one layer, then another layer. And that's what we did here. So we're pulsing, say, between minus 1.01 volts and minus 1.05 volts. This is for just magnetite, so we're actually changing the stoichiometry of the magnetite. We're varying the iron 2 to iron 3 ratio in this magnetite. And so this is the applied waveform. This is the current versus time. And we can tell that we have these super lattices by another symbol problem, by looking at the X-ray diffraction. And we get these things called satellites around the main Bragg peak. And from the position of the satellites, as the satellites move in, the modulation wavelength goes up. The modulation wavelength is the A plus B layer thickness. As they move out, the modulation wavelength goes down. So we can vary these things from maybe, oh, say, 5 nanometers up to 100 nanometers for the A plus B layer thickness. And you probably don't want to see all this. So anyway, this is more X-ray diffraction. It shows just how great it all is. And then these are zinc ferrite superlattices where we're varying the zinc concentration in the superlattice by pulsing the potential. And again, we're measuring this modulation wavelength by X-ray diffraction going from, say, 29 nanometers to about 12 nanometers. And, you know, that shows, you know, that we really have a modulated structure, but it's nice to see a picture too. So this is a cross-section of one of the superlattices. This has grown quite thicker. Modulation wavelength is thicker so that we could actually image it in our focused ion beam microscope that we have. Okay, so with the zinc ferrite superlattice, we've shown recently, again, this is unpublished, that it also exhibits this fairly large magnetoresistance. But the most important thing is that it has this other property called resistive switching that could be of interest for what we call resistive RAM. So if you vary, so we're doing perpendicular electronic transport measurements through this material, and we find that as we vary the current, as we vary the applied potential, the current goes like this, and it drops, and it goes like this, and it shoots up like this, goes off scale, comes back like this. So basically, by applying a certain voltage, you can either have it as a zero or one, or, you know, at this point you could go, say, minus one, so you have like three different states, minus one, zero, and plus one, so you could use it as a memory. And so here we're actually varying the current and looking at the applied voltage, and you can see all these multiple steps in the bias. So this is really of interest for resistive RAM. So the last part I'm going to talk about real fast, like the rest of the talk, is on nanostructured materials for lithium battery cathodes. And we're starting by making a sodium manganese oxide. And we deposit this from manganese to triethanolamine, again, in strong base. And we electrochemically oxidize the manganese 2 to iron 3, I mean to manganese 3. And it deposits as this sodium manganese oxide, which is actually a precursor to a lithium compound, lithium manganese oxide, which we can produce by electrochemically cycling this in a solution containing lithium, and we do produce this. And like I mentioned before, a big advantage of the electrodeposition is that you have electrical continuity from the electrode surface out to the end, out to the top. Whereas, you know, in lithium batteries now, what we do is we use, I don't do this, but other people do this, they use standard processing methods where they grind up powders, they press them, they use binders, and so there's a problem with connectivity from the bottom to the top. And also, these happen to, we don't do this intentionally, but they happen to deposit as nanostructure materials which have high surface area, which would give you high capacity. And this particular material doesn't revert to the spinel, which is actually actually kills these things. That's okay. And I don't have time to show it, but this, we've shown that this also functions as a supercapacitor, which I think is going to be talked about in the next talk. But basically, this is what these things look like. This is the IV curve that we use to deposit it. And we get these nano belts, or nano whatever they are, we'll call them nano belts, of sodium manganese oxide, but this is not epitaxial, this is actually just grown on stainless steel substrate. And then, like I say, if we cycle this in a lithium solution, then it produces a lithium manganese oxide. So we've shown that it actually acts as a supercapacitor. We don't know yet about the capacity for using it for a lithium battery. That's something that we need to determine. So besides the two speakers, the two other authors that I have on the paper, I'd like to acknowledge the additional graduate students and postdocs, and I'd also like to acknowledge the support from the National Science Foundation for the earlier work, and recently support from the Department of Energy. I'd also like to thank you.